From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The 36th special session of the Nevada legislature is over, and by all accounts, this special session was special indeed. At 7 days, the session that ended a week ago was among the longest in state history. It was also among the most prolific, with lawmakers passing more than a dozen bills. And for the first time, two-thirds of the state's lawmakers petitioned to add items to the agenda. So what came out of Carson City? Well, lawmakers put into place a system that will fund SNAP benefits in the event of another shutdown. They also passed a pair of bills aimed at improving traffic safety and protecting kids as they go to and from school. And the governor got his crime bill that puts into place tougher penalties for retail theft and reestablishes a tourism corridor court, albeit with an amendment that looks to prevent immigration officials from entering schools without a warrant. However, this special session may be best remembered for what didn't pass, most notably a $1.8 billion film tax deal, as well as a measure aimed at limiting corporate home ownership in the state. To help us break it all down is Assemblymember Selena LaRue Hatch, who represents Northwest Reno. Assemblymember, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, I want to get your take on this special session. You all passed roughly a dozen bills, but two of the most notable pieces of legislation, the film tax deal, the housing bill, both died. In your opinion, was this a successful session?
You know, from the start, I've been calling this the special interest session. It was not an emergency. It was not necessary. And ultimately, I don't think it was successful. I think that it wasted a lot of taxpayer time and dollars on issues that weren't immediate emergencies.
You've largely been credited with, at the very least, revealing that the film tax credit expansion was not a done deal, that there were still many concerns about how much it would cost the state. You did that by raising a procedural objection, forcing a vote on whether or not the bill would even be sent to a committee. By the narrowest of margin, the bill was allowed to move forward. You know, what was going through your mind when you called that vote?
You know, when I called that vote, I was sitting there thinking about the enormous destructive cost of that bill. I was thinking about the $300 million deficit that we were looking at. I was thinking about our kids in our schools that would be defunded. And I was thinking about the fact that it didn't have the votes, that it didn't have the public support. And really, we shouldn't be here on this bill. And so I was sitting there hoping that others would see that and that we wouldn't move forward with this destructive bill.
Did you know the vote would be that close?
I knew the vote would be that close. The most important thing you can do in that building is learn to count. And so when I called that motion, I knew that it didn't have the votes to pass. I did not expect the speaker to break the rules of the assembly to force a tie so that his bill could continue. But I knew for a fact that this film bill did not have the votes to pass and shouldn't have been on the agenda.
You know, this was the hallmark piece of legislation from this special session, for this special session, I should say. What do you think it says about the current leadership or about the process itself generally that this special session was called without actually having the votes to make this pass?
You know, I think that this is hugely embarrassing for Governor Lombardo to put this on the agenda without having the votes. I think that it shows an assembly leadership that was trying to force the issue. And I think the biggest thing it shows is that the governor and leadership were willing to allow corporate interests to come in and bribe and bully their way into trying to getting this bill to pass. And I think that it is really telling that this was a session in which corporate interests thought they could buy a bill. And there was a groundswell of bipartisan opposition that said, no, we are here for the people. We are not going to be bought.
That is Assemblymember Selena LaRue Hatch, who represents Northwest Reno. Also with us is Warren Hardy, a lobbyist and former Republican state senator. Warren, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
You've worked as a lawmaker and a lobbyist for more than 20 years now. This is not your first rodeo, so to speak. In your experience, how did this special session compare to those in the past?
Well, it was certainly unique, not only in terms of how many bills were on the agenda, but also a Republican governor calling a special session with, one vote shy of supermajorities for the other party. That instinctively for me signaled trouble, and I was assured that, the deals are done. Not talking about the film tax credit here, but the other things. But I really was skeptical. I thought this has the potential to go sideways in a hurry. It didn't, ultimately. I know it looks like it did, but for the most part, there was good bipartisan progress on a lot of the bills. You can argue about whether they're emergency measures or not, but for the most part, I thought folks work pretty well together, and I don't think, you know, the Democrats really took advantage of the opportunity to try to make the governor look bad, which I think was a positive. I think everybody worked in good faith. There were differences of opinion, to be sure, but there wasn't, I didn't see the real political shenanigans in terms of electoral stuff that you sometimes see in those situations. And I thought there might well be those types of things.
You know, there was a lot of legislation that moved through the special. Usually lawmakers only focus on one, maybe two limited pieces of provisions there, the proposals. This was a wide-ranging special. So help me understand, were there winners and losers in all of this?
Well, there are always winners and losers, right? I mean, a special session is a completely different set of dynamics from a regular session. The only sessions I've been involved in where there were these, a large number of issues was immediately following a special session where we'd sine die and then go into immediate special session to finish the business. That's sort of the preferred method because everybody's there, everything's fresh in their mind, the political dynamics are in play. Sending everybody home with sine die and bringing them back 3 months later on that type of a agenda is sort of uncharted waters. And I got to be honest with you, it didn't go as badly as I thought it was going to go. I thought that they did good work on the crime bill. They did good work on the health care stuff. The film tax credit was unsettled. Nobody knew going in. And you know, one could argue that you really shouldn't call a special session until there's agreement, because deals don't hold. I know everybody says, well, we've got an agreement in place on the crime bill or the health care bill, but those don't hold in special sessions. Sometimes budget deals hold where we go into special session because there's a budgetary need. Those deals oftentimes hold and you go in for a quick special session and resolve them. But policy issues, deals on policy issues never hold. Something always comes up. How many bills did we have introduced? I mean, there was certainly the legislature exercising their right to put a bill on a concept on the proclamation, but there were also other bills that fit within the proclamation that nobody really thought of. The heart and lung bill, for example, is one that's a major, major policy issue that
you're talking
be
about
discussed.
A bill that would essentially say that any sort of first responder who gets a lung ailment, say cancer or COPD, something like that, later in life, that would automatically be service related, which would also cost municipalities quite a bit of money.
Well, that's the irony, right? That's something I've been involved with since 2002, 2001 session. And the irony of it could, the results of this session, if the governor decides to sign that bill, actually could create a fiscal emergency for local governments.
Warren, let me stop you there.
That came out of nowhere.
Let me stop you there. And yes, you're right. That was a bill that many saw maybe not as a urgent emergency right now. Assemblymember Lou Hatch, you know, going back to the film tax credits, you know, we've already seen Laborers Local 872 take back some of their endorsements for current lawmakers. They're one of the trade unions that strongly back the film bill. That Southern Nevada group says they plan to become more active in Northern Nevada politics in particular. Does that concern you?
You know, my job in the Nevada legislature is to represent the people of Assembly District 25, and most especially the working people who can't afford to take time off to drive to Carson and can't afford a fancy lobbyist to come in there and make their wishes known. And so from the start, my job has been to make sure their voices are heard, and I feel like I have done that. I am a union member. I am a strong supporter of unions. I have a great relationship with the Northern building trades, with other Northern unions, and my vote here was in line with those union values. It doesn't help union members to fund these jobs and then defund their schools. It doesn't help union members to take away state jobs to pay for temporary construction jobs. What we need is long-term jobs for everybody that benefits the entire public, right? Like light rail and those kinds of things. So I'm not concerned because I will continue to be a voice for my community. And if they're unhappy with me, they won't send me back and I'll have a lot more free time on my hands.
Warren, we have a couple minutes left. Do you foresee serious election implications from the future for the failure to pass this film tax credit?
You know, I don't. Look, I have watched several of these tax incentives go, and this one just didn't pencil out in the minds of enough legislators. I mean, you don't listen to the debate. This was an honest disagreement on whether this actually penciled out. I didn't hear anybody say tax incentives are a bad idea. So in the fog of war, there's always those kinds of conversations. I was the recipient of a lot of that when I was in the Senate. Oh, you're going to lose your election if you do this. I supported the tax increase in 2003 and 2009, and both times I was told I was going to lose my job. And both times I won with good majorities, or at least in 2006. So you vote your conscience. You do what's right. And if you can defend it to your constituents, they understand. They're smart people. They understand what you're doing. So always in the fog of war, there's conversations about political consequences. But in reality, unless it's self-serving, the electorate tends to give elected officials the benefit of the doubt for voting their conscience. It's when you can't defend yourself or you did something for political reasons that causes problems. I listened to Assemblymember LaRue Hatch's comments, and she was voting her conviction. That just doesn't ever come back to bite you. There's always a lot of noise about it, but if you're voting your conviction and you have real reasons to do it, the political ramifications are never as dire as they look in the fog of war.
That is where we're going to have to leave it for today. Warren Hardy is a former Republican state senator turned lobbyist. Selena LaRue Hatch represents Northwest Reno in the Nevada Assembly. Warren, Assemblymember LaRue Hatch, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and many of us have probably already started preparing our turkeys, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce. Or perhaps for our devoted NPR fans, the late Susan Stamberg's famous cranberry relish. But not everyone. The fall holidays in the U.S. include a great variety of traditions, some that apply to cultural groups and others that are particular to individual families. Recently, KNPR's Heidi Kaiser talked with a group of foodies from a variety of backgrounds about their particular customs for this time of year. Joining her were Tammy Tiger, director of UNLV's Tribal Education Initiative, DJ Flores, founder of Milpa Mexican Restaurant, and Lorraine Blanco Moss, a Las Vegas food writer, chef, and regular Desert Companion contributor.
Tammy, DJ, and Lorraine, welcome.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You, thanks for having
Hello.
Us.
I'm so happy you're here. Tammy, I want to start with you. First of all, happy Native American Heritage Month.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now that it's the end of November and Thanksgiving is upon us, I want to first ask you, what would you like listeners to remember when they're putting dinner on the table around the 27th?
Well, I think traditionally in America, Thanksgiving is a time of gathering, a time of being with your family, a time of giving thanks, of course. But it's important to know that that is not a true and accurate story that our children are told, usually in school, about the pilgrims and meeting the Native American, the tribes of that area. Back then, it was actually like a fabricated story. And it's recognized by the people of the First Light, who were the first contact tribes on the East Coast, as a day of prayer and a day of mourning. And they actually call it a day of mourning, and they hold a special ceremony on their tribal lands. And there's also one that happens on Alcatraz, because it is symbolic of just a lot of the tragedy and things that have happened to our peoples since then, since the first contact.
The beginning of colonization.
Yes.
And what will you be doing on November 27th?
So my celebrations definitely have evolved over the years, as because I grew up off reservation and just really learned about the history of my own people over the last 20 years, and the truth of Thanksgiving coming out, and it made me really reflect on, you know, how I wanted to honor that day. And so what I do now is I've been learning more dishes and recipes that I can use that are decolonized or indigenized, because it is all of the foods that we eat on that day are from indigenous foods to this land. So I don't get together in the same way that I do, that I did growing up. Now I get together with friends, or I'm at home and cooking, or just being with family, but not necessarily like your traditional Thanksgiving meal on Thursday. However, the next day is Native American Day. And so usually I'll do something gathering with my family, prepare traditional foods for us, and celebrate in that way.
Tammy, many of our listeners will have heard of the so-called Three Sisters mm-hmm. ingredients. Can you talk about what those are and what the cultural significance is of those ingredients to you?
Yes, the Three Sisters are corn, beans, and squash. They were grown as companion plants, and they're grown all over the country, actually. And so there's a ton of different recipes with the base ingredients of corn, beans, and squash. Sometimes they're together, sometimes they're separate, but they're definitely a staple. Even corn is known as like the mother food to many of us and in our indigenous culture. So I'll say in the spring and summer, it's a Three Sisters salad. In the winter, fall times of harvest, it's maybe more of a stew.
What kinds of meals might you be preparing around this time of year using those ingredients?
So the corn specifically, we have a dish in my tribe. It's Choctaw and Muscogee, and it's called Tanchi Labona. And it's a corn and pork stew, and it's made from both like regular corn and hominy, and then pieces of roasted pork. And I spice it up with a little green chili in my recipe. But that's a traditional stew that I like to make during this time of year.
It sounds a little bit like, what's the name of the hominy stew?
Pozole.
It sounds a little bit mm-hmm. like pozole. Am I right, DJ?
Yes, Flores? It does. Yes.
And speaking of corn, DJ, you are someone to whom corn is also quite important. As the founder of Milpa, a Mexican restaurant, you have large bags of heirloom corn delivered to the restaurant to make your corn tortillas. Why is that specific corn so important for you to use?
I mean, it all starts, you know, kind of like the history of corn and how it used to be traditionally done. We came back to our roots, right? So I worked in Mexico City, saw what they do for just a normal, you know, casual tortilla. Whereas in Vegas, we really don't really see it. So I wanted to come back and you know, show the process to our staff and show the process to our customers. We wanted to bring back that tradition, and people are loving it. It's the heirloom varieties, all from Mexico. It's really telling a story of how we should be looking at each ingredient. So all of our corn masa is done in-house. All of our tortillas is done in-house. So we're trying to just educate the crowd in the Vegas City market to like realize, hey, this is a better corn for you.
And what are some of the other dishes that use corn at Milpa?
I mean, so right now it's we're getting into traditional, you know, holiday spirit. So tamales is well known, and everybody's doing a tamale. Right now, what we're doing at Milpa is some birria tamales, some chicken, and with a salsa verde tamales, which are like the popular favorites. So we're using all of our corn in house, and I think it gives it a good flavor, a good corn flavor. It's really like enhancing the corn flavor, and this is like what people love about Milpa. It's just good ingredients and good process.
And you alluded to this earlier when you were talking about educating people who come in the restaurant and really connecting with the traditional farming. But I think Milpa actually refers to a farming system. Is that right?
Yes. It's actually kind of based on Three Sisters. You can't grow corn without the beans and the squash. So the heirloom varieties are very land-raised corn varieties. We're working with a couple of vendors now, apart from Macienda. Macienda also delivers corn from small farms from Mexico. But I got to know this other company called Somos Maíz. They're a great company. They also kind of are getting with the small families, and the small families they have like just pieces of their yard in the back, and they're growing their own corn, and they're kind of like, hey, we need this corn to survive, so can you help us out, deliver, distribute this corn? So they're really kind of educating me on how the corn is evolved and how corn is kind of, you know, diminishing with the heirloom corn out in Mexico. So we really want to kind of like, hey, this is really good corn, and we want to, like, you know, educate our customers, to tell them the story. And it's really about, you know, how can we kind of educate them also as well as other ingredients with other vegetables and other grains out there, because there is more grains to get to know in Mexico that isn't known here in the States.
Lorraine Blanco-Moss, as a Las Vegas food writer, how do you see some of those interesting ingredients like the Three Sisters being used more broadly in the dining scene?
So I think that a lot of chefs nowadays are very aware of how people across cultures are celebrating Thanksgiving differently or not celebrating Thanksgiving. And I think it's, well, first of all, I think it's not that hard to incorporate it because we do use corn, squash, and beans. I mean, we have a green bean casserole. We have cornbread, butternut squash. These are things that are very easy to incorporate into your Thanksgiving dinner. And that seems to be the case across the board, like a barbecue place, a mainstream provisions kind of place, a Sparrow and Wolf kind of place. They're all doing interesting things with those ingredients. And I think it's not just that they're doing it, but they're also aware of it and saying it, which I think is cool and interesting. I think I started in 2020 during the pandemic because I had more time to think about indigenous people and how they may celebrate or not celebrate the holiday. And so I've every year since then tried to do something that was related to Three Sisters, the Three Sisters. Also, as somebody who's multiracial, I have to imagine all the time that people are going to bring things that are from all different kinds of cultures. And so my mom will make an arroz gordo, which is a Portuguese version of like a fat rice. It's like tomato based with a ton of different kinds of meats in it. Not for you. But Portuguese people love their meat. It's like a full, it's everything has meat in it. For me, I try to incorporate the cultures that I grew up in, Portuguese, Filipino, Spanish. So every year I do a Basque burnt cheesecake instead of a, you know, traditional cheesecake. It's traditional to me. It's actually a lot more delicious. Whenever you get that char on something, right, DJ? It's like it adds that extra flavor to it. And then I'm going to be doing an ube bread pudding to kind of celebrate Filipino culture. And so, yeah, it'll be international and it'll be also try to be aware of what we're thinking about here. But for us, it's also a time for gathering. And so it's not, we'll definitely celebrate it, but be mindful.
And for people who like might want to incorporate all Three Sisters into just like one dish, that's really easy because I know
oh my.
You. Yeah. Sorry, or maybe two, or you know something like that. Can you share one of the things that you've learned to prepare over the last few years that might be easy for people to do at home?
So to be honest, I've never tried to do all three together, but I always do three. And Tammy would be perfect for this.
Okay, let's see. Yeah.
I have a recipe. Actually, that's my leftover recipe. So if you think about it, all the foods that people eat, they're just prepared differently. Mm-hmm. We just didn't use dairy. We didn't use white sugar. We didn't use flour. So, but my Three Sisters stew is the leftover turkey leg, the green beans, the corn, you know, from the corn recipe. You just put it all into a stew and add some broth and cook it slow, and that's great for leftovers.
Sounds delicious.
I feel like in general, there's not enough squash on tables mm-hmm. any day of the week, but especially Thanksgiving. You know, it's such an amazing, you know, tasty food. I mean, you've got acorn squash, you've got butternut squash. It's not just like, you know, yellow squash. Like, there's so many different kinds. With acorn squash, you can like roast it super duper high and put salt and pepper in it, and it's absolutely stunningly delicious.
You can also put stuffing in the cavity
yes.
and bake it like that, and it's a great
yes.
It's a great main dish for people who are doing a plant-based. Am I?
Yeah, yeah, like a squash tamal or
yes.
At Milpa we have mm-hmm. a squash tetela, so it's something unique, you know. It's people want something unique and but still kind of traditional. So.
And it's savory sweet,
yes,
which I love.
Exactly.
It's that balance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I combine it the butternut squash with sweet potatoes.
Oh, tell me more.
Yeah,
do you
them.
Puree it or cubed?
No, cube,
or?
Cube them together and use a little bit of maple and citrus and roast them that way.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Do you guys have a kitchen over here so we can?
That'll be for next year's Thanksgiving show. DJ, restaurateurs are sometimes the best sources of restaurant recommendations, right? Because you're, you know, all your friends are in the business. If someone isn't cooking for Thanksgiving and they want to go out, what places do you recommend for them?
I mean, is there a lot of there isn't a lot of I guess restaurants off the strip. So I would suggest. If you don't want to do traditional, I would say go to Jaleo. Go to Jaleo, eat some Spanish food.
And are you, Lorraine, are you going to be cooking at home or are you going to be going out for the, because you have a toddler now, so.
Yeah, I 1 year did a takeout Thanksgiving. It was a very good restaurant, but I almost cried because I was so sad. Thanksgiving is my Super Bowl. Mm. That's what I call it. In terms of cooking, you know, it's not like, I get it. It's not the greatest holiday to celebrate in terms of traditionally what we think about growing up, especially in the age group that I am. It was very weird the way they taught it to us in the 80s. But in terms of celebrating, for me, it's just the idea of having all my family there and I can cook all the things and just go completely nuts on it. And so I always do it. That was the 1 year I didn't, and I will never do that again because it's fun for me. I don't feel stressed about it.
And what are you going to be cooking?
Ube bread pudding, the Bass cheesecake. That's already, the ingredients are already around for that. I'm going to do a spatchcock turkey. So I've been doing that every year because you get a better, I highly recommend it. Even for someone that's an amateur, you just cut the back out of the turkey and lay it flat. And you're going to get a crispier turkey. You're going to get a more moist turkey. And a lot of the time, just with all of that, it's going to be more flavorful. Also, it cuts down your cooking time by many, many hours. So I will dry brine. I will spatchcock. And then I'll put a bunch of citrus and root vegetables and bunch of herbs under it, some chicken stock or vegetable stock or whatever stock that I have available. And then roast it really high temperature for just like 2 hours when you spatchcock it, maybe 3 max.
Wow. That's an argument for doing it right there.
Yes, absolutely. And never, please never buy cranberry sauce.
Oh, yes.
It makes me so sad. That's the one thing for sure that I would recommend. There are so many recipes online that are so easy to find. And
it takes so much better.
It tastes so much better, and I swear it takes less than 10 minutes to do. Yeah. You just hear those cranberries pop, and you're in business.
I love the pop. Nice. It's also great. That's a great thing with toddlers, too, is like, yeah. What are you going to be cooking at home, DJ?
I'm not going to be cooking.
You're taking the day off.
I'm going to go visit my mom, and she's going to be cooking tamales all day, so I'm going to enjoy that.
Nice, nice.
Yay, that's so lucky.
Yes, exactly.
It is.
The one day I'm not cooking, so.
It's a break.
Yeah,
it's
no,
a break
you
break.
Deserve
yeah.
it.
You're going to be eating. Tammy, are there any harvest festivals or fall festivals that that people could go to if they're interested?
No harvest festivals per se come to mind, but there is a new space at Springs Preserve that I really think people should go to learn more about the indigenous foods from this area. It's from the Newell Posats. Which is a Southern Paiute garden, and it's an ethnobotanical garden. It's just opening this month. And so they do have like a field of corn there that even though it's not traditional from here, but they also have a number of other foods from this area with elders talking about how they were prepared and how they sustained the Southern Paiute people from this area.
For listeners who don't observe Thanksgiving, are there alternative events taking place, or can you suggest some other ways of observing or maybe celebrating or just thinking about this day?
Absolutely. I would go out on the land. That's always like the best way to observe and have just space with yourself or enjoy nature. And really, what better things can you give than out to the land and what all of that it gives to us?
And anything else that you would like folks to remember as we head toward November 27th and what many people think of as Thanksgiving, what would you like people to think about?
I would like them to think about the truth of the history of that story of Thanksgiving. Think about Indigenous people. Think about whose land you're on and how do you give back and how do you share more information about that and just help us to raise awareness.
Tammy Tiger is UNLV's Director of Tribal Education Initiative and a citizen of the Choctaw Nation, as she discussed, and a descendant of the Muscogee and Seminole Nations. DJ Flores is the founder of Milpa Mexican Restaurant, and Lorraine Blanco Moss is our own food writer and contributor and a former chef. Tammy, DJ, Lorraine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
And we will have some recipes and suggestions that they mentioned, as well as links to other resources about Thanksgiving on our website at knpr.org.
The holiday season is typically the time of year when football fans around the country set their sights on the postseason. Even teams with a middling record have been known to fight their way into the playoffs. Unfortunately, when it comes to the Las Vegas Raiders, any hope of a playoff run this season may be perhaps utter fantasy. This year, the team is 2-9, losing the last five games in a row, and the most recent loss was to the Cleveland Browns, whose rookie players dominated the Raiders 24-10, with quarterback Geno Smith getting sacked 10 times, ultimately leading to the ousting of offensive coordinator Chip Kelly, who was just hired earlier this year. It was an abysmal loss that is causing some to question whether this is the worst team in franchise history. Covering it all is Case Kiefer. He's the assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Sun. Case, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
The Raiders just had a relatively embarrassing loss against the Cleveland Browns over the weekend that you characterized in one of your recent headlines as the worst loss yet. The team is 2-9. Why was this loss so bad?
Yeah, well, certainly they had some more lopsided ones. They were historically beaten at Kansas City. They got blown out at Indianapolis and Washington. But I think this one was particularly disheartening just because these are two teams, the Browns and the Raiders, that are kind of in the same situation, both clearly not going anywhere this year. This should have been like a developing year for young players. And you kind of saw that head-to-head with the Browns. The Browns' young players dominated the game, made all the difference, as you alluded to. And the Raiders' rookies and young players are barely getting on the field. The Browns were only one of two teams left in the NFL that the Raiders would be favored to beat. And not only did the Raiders not beat them, they never even threatened to beat them. I mean, the 24-10 final score is flattering. They were just totally outplayed in every area where the Browns kind of gave their the big crowd they brought to Allegiant Stadium hope for the future, whereas the Raiders just looked totally lost at this point.
You know, over the weekend, the Raiders fired offensive coordinator Chip Kelly 1 year into his contract, less than a year into his contract. They lured him away from Ohio State by making him the highest paid assistant coach in the NFL. I think it was widely understood that Kelly would essentially have carte blanche in running the offense, but from what we've seen on the field, nothing seems like it's clicking. What has happened there?
Yeah, it's just it's been a complete disaster. So much has gone wrong. I think in a lot of fans' minds, and it's probably a fair characterization, as it starts on the offensive line. Arguably, their two best blockers, Colton Miller and Jackson Powers Johnson, are hurt, and they just haven't found the right combination without those guys. It was kind of bizarre all offseason once the new coaching staff came in, and new administration led by general manager John Spytek and Coach Pete Carroll. They were adamant that they thought they had the pieces in place to be a good offensive line. I think that made Raiders fans uneasy, and some people that cover the team were kind of thinking, well, really? And I guess the people that had reservations were right, because this is one of the NFL's worst offensive lines. They can't protect anyone. And all that being said, I think the offensive line might be taking a little bit too much of the blame, because also they just made what looks like a really poor decision to trade for one of the Pete Carroll's favorite players he's ever coached in Seattle, Geno Smith at quarterback, who's just been really underperformed, one of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL. And that's a big deal when you're paying the guy $35 million per year. I don't have the exact figure, something around that. He's just been a huge letdown and hasn't given them much of a chance to win.
You mentioned head coach Pete Carroll there. You know, this is his first season with the team as well. What role does he play in all this? You know, what does he have to say for himself?
I mean, I honestly think this whole mess is his mess. I mean, Chip, this is not a defense of Chip Kelly. He clearly didn't do a good job. He did have carte blanche at first. I think the offense was in his image at first, but then you saw Pete Carroll start meddling more. You know, ultimately, a lot of these firings come down to needing a scapegoat, and I feel like that's kind of the same situation here. I just feel like Pete Carroll's best years as a coach, unfortunately, might be behind him. I mean, it doesn't take anything away from all the great accomplishments he has. One of the only coaches with a college football national championship and a Super Bowl. But I just don't think he was the right guy for this Raiders job. That needs someone that's going to grow, going to build the team year over year. And he said it time and time again that he's not even really invested in playing young players. He wants to win right now, even when the team's 2-9 and has no chance of getting to the playoffs. I just think they really need someone with a more longer picture view. And the interests of the organization and the head coach didn't align from the moment they hired him, which I think made this such a bad decision. And I wrote all this, so I'm not just being Mr. Hindsight here, but it's just made it a bigger debacle than it ever should be with, I feel like, the two's interests not aligning.
You know, there's six games left in the season. Is there anything the organization can do to salvage the last couple of weeks?
I know I keep harping on this, but I just think the number one thing is they have to play some of these young players, that they need to be development minded. And every week, Pete Carroll's asking his news conference, okay, are we going to see some young guys this week? He's like, that's just not how I operate. I want my best guys on the field. I'm trying to win every game. And the fact of the matter is the Raiders just haven't won in a long time. They have one playoff appearance here in Las Vegas. They drafted 11 guys. Usually when you have that big of a draft class, you would want to do everything to get them on the field, especially with a losing team. And really only one of them is playing consistently, their first-round pick, Ashton Jeanty, and he hasn't even played very well. They took an offensive lineman in the third round, and despite the state of their offensive line, he's been inactive most games. He has one snap on the year. I just think someone really needs to convince Carroll that, hey, let's just take our lumps. We're losing anyway. We need to get some experience for these guys. We need to try to develop some of our young players.
Of course, long before the Raiders even dreamed of setting up shop in Las Vegas, the Nevada Wolfpack and UNLV Rebels have been duking it out on the gridiron for decades. And this week is the 50th battle for Nevada and the Fremont Cannon between the Nevada Wolfpack and UNLV Rebels. Here to help us break down the world of college football is Chris Murray, digital manager for Nevada Sports Bet and co-host of NSN Daily. Chris, before we get into this week's game, talk to me about the Wolfpack. They've had a rough couple of seasons. In 2023, they went 2-10. Last year, they were 3-10. This year, they're 3-8. What's going on?
It really just dates back to Jay Norvell leaving the Wolfpack for Colorado State after the 2021 season. Up until that point, Nevada had made it to a bowl game in 14 of the previous 17 seasons, so it maybe wasn't a championship-caliber program, but it was a program that was at least respectable and usually playing in the postseason. After that defection, with Jay Norvell going to Colorado State, becoming the first sitting Mountain West head coach to go to another Mountain West school, and then citing the lack of institutional support for football, things have just really fallen apart. So 2-10 and 2-10 under Ken Wilson, he's fired after two seasons. That's a pretty quick trigger. Jeff Choate comes in and he says he's going to launch the program. There's not going to be a rebuild. And then they go 3-10 in his first season, although they were more competitive on the field. And then this year they start 1-8. Now they have won back-to-back games for the first time under Jeff Choate to build a little bit of momentum getting into this Fremont Cannon game on Saturday at Mackey Stadium. If you win that one, maybe you can try and spin this as a success. You've gone from 3 wins to 4 wins and retained the Fremont Cannon, but it really has been a struggle. And football is one of the chief reasons Nevada was not invited to the Pac-12 when the Mountain West Pac-12 split happened two Septembers ago. So it certainly has been a major issue. Football is the most important sport on campus. And the Wolfpack just has not figured out that sport over the last couple of years, and some of its facilities, some of its NIL. And the Wolfpack is trying to push more chips in to be better in football, but the results have been pretty sparing thus far.
The Wolfpack season is over after this week's rivalry game. So what are your takeaways at this point? Were there any bright spots from this particular season?
There was improvement on defense. There was improvement on special teams. I think the offense has been a major issue. Outside of one game against San Jose State 2 weeks ago, where Nevada put up 55 points, Nevada's not scored more than 22 points in any other game. You look at UNLV, the team Nevada's going to be playing this week, the Rebels have scored at least 29 points in 10 of their 11 games. College football is designed more than even the NFL to be able to go out there and light up the scoreboard and put up 30-plus points. And really, you look at Nevada's 4 years of struggles, it's mostly been on the offense. The Wolfpack used to have an electric offense under Chris Ault, College Football Hall of Famer, created the pistol offense, created a number of other offensive schemes. And Wolfpack football's kind of forever been known for its offensive profile, just has not been able to score points. So, I think the goal this year was to make it back to a bowl game. That was like the minimum level for a successful season. That was not accomplished. Is Jeff Choate on the hot seat? I don't think so. He's still got 3 more years on his deal. $2.7 million buyout. Nevada's not a school that's going to buy out a coach for that figure. And there have been like some progress away from maybe the win-loss totals. Nevada did break ground on a new indoor football practice facility. That's something the program's wanted for 20-plus years. That's something that almost every other cold weather program in the FBS has. You know, it has boosted the budget for football pretty considerably as well. And the hope is this will eventually lead to results. Like I said, though, the results just have not been good in recent years.
We've got about a minute left, guys, and I really wanted to get into UNLV, but we're not going to be able to do that. They are a much different story, though. They are 9-2, very much likely heading to a bowl game. Case, talk to me about this week's battle for Nevada. We've got about 30 seconds left. What are your predictions for the game?
I would expect UNLV to win. That's not exactly being bold. I mean, they're more than a touchdown favorite. I do think it will be competitive, though. I mean, despite UNLV being 9-2, they're probably fortunate to have that strong of a record. They have some defensive holes that have kind of been shored up in the last couple weeks. But I expect a pretty competitive game. But ultimately, I can't be bold enough to go with the upset.
Chris, 10 seconds. What do you think?
Yeah, same page. I just don't think Nevada can score enough to hold off UNLV. I think the Rebels keep the cannon red for the fourth straight season.
All right, we'll leave it there. Case Kiefer is the assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Sun. Chris Murray is the co-host of NSN Daily and the digital manager for NevadaSportsNet.com. Case, Chris, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Let's start with art, and this one's important in part because it actually closes today, November 26th.
Yes, and the gallery closes at 6 p.m., so consider this for your lunch break or your dry happy hour or maybe just a pre-shift enlightenment for those of you that work swing. And a reason to prioritize this visit is that the exhibiting artist, Daniel Esquivia Zapata, hails from Colombia. And this not only gives our Vegas community a good look at artwork and a perspective from outside of this country, but it also gives the host art space, in this case, the Fine Arts Gallery at CSN Cheyenne's Nicholas J. Horn Theater, the message that our community supports exhibits of international artists. Zapata's aesthetic is very unique. His specialty is drawing human figures, very large human figures, in fact, and the works in this exhibit are big, especially for drawings. What makes them unique is the detail and the anatomical accuracy with which he renders those figures, as well as the adornments that surround them. Zapata's other specialties are memory and history, especially as they pertain to social movements and violence. And often there are newspaper and archival and or fragmented text also worked into the drawings and these mixed media pieces. And the results are very striking. They're very multidimensional, though I feel like your eyes always go back to the central figure of each of these works. And again, you've got till 6 p.m. to see Zapata's work at CSN Cheyenne.
All right. It sounds like the clock is ticking. And speaking of, let's move over to holiday music. 'Tis officially the season, or at least it will be when this concert happens today as well.
Yes, hopefully you can also squeeze in this late afternoon concert at UNLV's Artemis Ham Hall. This is with the Vienna Boys Choir. Paul, guess how far back this choir goes?
I don't know, 150 years?
Try 525 years. Among the oldest music groups in the world, giving the Rolling Stones a run for their money, the members of the choir are far younger. Between the ages of 9 and 14, there are no less than four choirs of about 25 singers each traveling the world, and they perform a total of about 300 concerts annually at no expense to their rigorous studies and training. And rigorous could be understating it, because these kids already know significant parts of music theory, and I take all that to mean that they're really, really good.
So what are they saying?
Well, spoiler alert, UNLV has already posted a partial set list, and there are some surprises galore here. Of course, you're going to get a banger like Hark the Herald Angels Sing, but you also get two songs known for their incorporation in the Sister Act movies. You get lesser sung Christmas carols like I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day and This Little Babe. And naturally, you're going to get Es wird scho gleich dunkel.
I'm sorry, what?
That is a famous Christmas lullaby in Austria that translates to It Will Soon Be Dark. And that's a song to ostensibly comfort children, or in this instance, the baby Jesus. All of this to say, this is not your usual Christmas music program of the same 10 well-known songs, thankfully, though it is traditional in the international sense. And this one is at 3 p.m.
Everything is so early this time of year. All right, for your final pick, you have a family-friendly festival that actually has nothing to do with the holidays and does not happen today.
And it involves kites. When was the last time you flew a kite, Paul?
We're not going to talk about that.
Well, I will venture to say it goes back to about seventh grade for myself. But we have 2 days to relive that old kite flying glory on November 28th and 29th. That's Friday and Saturday at the Las Vegas World Kite Festival. Yes, you can fly kites, but you can also make them or learn to make and fly them. You can watch others fly them, including several international kite teams who are performing at the festival. You can see huge kites shaped like animals and dragons, including this 100-meter dragon that flies at night all illuminated. And you can most certainly buy them and all the flair that goes with them. Furthermore, they will have all the other usual festival trimmings like food, live music, art installations for selfies, games, bouncy castles, and retail, all representative of cultures from around the world. Tickets start at $5 for admission, and they go up for various VIP offerings. And the event goes from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Desert Breeze Park.
All right, Mike, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.